Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. I'm Anton Garcia Fernandez, and I'm talking to everyone out there from a little town in northwest Tennessee. And this new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast will be available on iTunes, on YouTube, and also on the Jazz Flashes blog at jazzflashes.blogspot.com. And today we have a very special show, a very special guest who is joining us from Montclair, New Jersey, and he's a man that we've talked about with Chris Byers the other day when we were doing our previous episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. He's a musician, a discographer, a collector, a researcher, a historian, and thanks to the wonders of present-day technology, he is joining us from New Jersey. I'm talking about Noel Cohen. Hello, Noel. Thanks for being here, and welcome to the Jazz Flashes podcast.
Well, thank you, Anton. It's a total pleasure for me to be here, and an honor, too, for that matter.
Well, we really and truly appreciate it, because I, for one, am very interested in the idea of the discography. The discographies over the years have helped me a lot in my own research and readings and acquiring knowledge about jazz. So we're going to be talking about that, but we'll talk about several other things. We can basically talk about anything that you want here on the air.
Sure.
To start, maybe giving a little bit of background about yourself, about your activities. Could you tell us a little bit about you, Noel, for those listeners out there who may not be acquainted with your wonderful work, with your books, and also with your website?
Sure. I'm originally from upstate New York, Rochester, New York, and I've worn many hats throughout my life. I'm not just a music person. I've done many other things as well. I worked in industry for many years, but the music thing really started in my teenage years up in Rochester, which is like the early 1950s. That's frighteningly long time ago at this point. And I really got into jazz about 1952 or 1953. My mother was the buyer of records and phonographs at a large downtown Rochester retail store, department store. And she would bring home a lot of recordings. At first they were 78s. And then in the early 1950s came along the LPs. First they were 10-inch LPs and then 12-inch LPs. And my parents liked to dance, so they brought a lot of dance music. So I started to hear the big bands, Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, let's see, strangely, Billy May. Mm-hmm. Billy May had an interesting band in the early 1950s, very unique arrangements. And she brought home Billy May, Ralph Flanagan, I'll mention Guy Lombardo.
Oh yeah,
you know, not really jazz, but popular music. And one thing I should say, in those days, there was a much closer relationship between popular music and jazz than there is now. They were much more closely related. Rhythm and blues, jazz, popular music. They all had, you know, a 4-4 time feel pretty much, and it was easy to go from one to the other. But the first jazz I heard, okay, so this is the early 1950s, and it's so my mother also brought home Benny Goodman. There were two early 12-inch LPs, which were like collections of 78 original 78 RPM issues. One was Benny Goodman Combos, and the other was the Benny Goodman Big Band. And the Combos were these great sides with Charlie Christian, you know, and Cootie Williams, Georgie Auld, Teddy Wilson, Lionel Hampton blew me away. You know, I mean, that's the first kind of music that I heard. And then I had a cousin who's about 5 years older than me and a fine clarinetist. He spent much of his career at the Met in New York City. Very fine player, and he was into jazz at the time, so he gave me some of his 78s, Charlie Parker, Lester Young, Jumping with Symphony Sid. Mm-hmm. Never forget that stuff. That was it. That's all it took. I was hooked, you know. And so the early 1950s, what was in vogue at the time? Well, at that time, bebop was kind of in decline. So what was in vogue was West Coast jazz. So some of my first 10-inch LPs were people like Jerry Mulligan and Chet Baker, Shorty Rogers and his Giants, Hampton Hawes, Herb Geller, Stan Kenton. A lot of that was recorded on the West Coast, and a lot of those guys had played in the bands of Stan Kenton and Woody Herman. So that was like the first, you know, music, the first stuff that I collected. But it's interesting because, you know, you sort of, your first exposure is to what's in vogue at the time. And then later on, I would, you know, listen to Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and even Bird, you know. But, you know, then I started to really branch out, and I played. So I now, as far as me being a musician, that might be an apt description. I did take some drum lessons in Rochester at a local with a teacher at a local music store, but I hated practicing. And I never really learned properly. So throughout my musical career, such as it was, I never really had the tools and the versatility, you know, to really make a professional career, have a professional career as a performer. Nonetheless, I played along with records. I drove my neighbors crazy. Playing along with records, not with headphones, but along with the hi-fi system, you know, and yeah, that caused a lot of complaints to my parents. But that's basically how I learned to play what I could play, and I did manage to, in some ways, capture the feel, if not the technique, of people like Max Roach and Philly Joe Jones and Art Taylor and Shelly Mann. So now here's another thing you have to be aware of with regard to that point in time. And that is that the players back then were not as good as the players of today. I mean, the kids today in high school are, in many cases, near professional level.
You mean technically?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You mean technically?
Technically, yeah. We'll get to the other part of it, which is much more complicated. But in terms of ability, you know, of technical ability, I got away with murder, you know, because there were just nobody, there weren't that many players around that knew what the feeling of jazz was, and certainly the feeling of 1950s jazz, because by that time it was hard bop, you know. So I had that feeling, if not a whole lot of technique. So now I started out playing with a bar mitzvah band. Now this band was not very good. They would play bar mitzvah receptions practically every Saturday night. They had a gig. And that earned me a little money, which I almost totally invested back into, you know, buying records. Now, jazz records. Now, by 1955, that's when the 12-inch LP came in. And that was this flood of recordings from Prestige and Blue Note and Bethlehem. It was mind-boggling. And I was picking up practically everything that came out, and also the big labels, Columbia, RCA, Victor, Decca. I mean, the music was just, you can't believe what a wonderland it was at that time. You know, the Eisenhower era.
Now, that definitely was a golden era for jazz.
It was the great just labels, absolutely the golden era. You know, just endless music. I mean, okay, so as I said, I started out listening to the West Coast music, but by about, okay, here's the record that I think really started the hard bop thing off. Well, maybe there were two. One was the Walkin' Bloomin' Boogie session, Miles Davis on Prestige, okay, with J.J. Johnson, Lucky Thompson, Horace Silver, Percy Heath, and Kenny Clark. That was one recording that really turned things around. And also, I think the 1953 recordings that Miles did with on Blue Note, with Jimmy Heath on some and J.J., like Tempest Fugit, and Art Blakey, that sock symbol, it was so influential, the way he drove those bands, you know. So by about 1955, things were really changing. The rhythm was much more subtle than bebop was. There was kind of a churchy influence, you know, especially with, you know, Horace Silver, the Preacher. Later on, it would become even more pronounced in that direction. It was more funky, was the word that was used. But there was another very important thing that happened in the mid-1950s, and that was the evolution of great composers. Now, there were always great composers. Duke Ellington, you know, I mean, there were always great composers, but what happened in the 1950s was people like Horace Silver and Lucky Thompson and Kenny Dorham, and the list goes on and on, Mingus, you know, and now what was happening, Hank Mobley, now what was happening was that the music, the repertoire, was suddenly expanding, you know, in a huge way. Because with bebop, you were basically playing a few standards, all the things you are, and tunes based on standards and blues, and I got rhythm changes, you know, and they weren't really composing things, you know.
There were just variations in that way.
I'm sorry?
There were just variations in that way of certain themes that had already been played back to the swing era and before. So.
Right. And then the Lenny Tristano, Lee Konitz, the Warren Marsh School, everything were what are known as contrafacts. That's tunes that are based on the chord changes of other songs. They totally, everything they wrote was based on a standard, pretty much. But now you had these new composers coming along and writing, you know, material that was not in some Benny Golson. You know, I forgot to mention him, Randy Weston. You know, this music was now getting much more interesting, much more intriguing, and much richer. You know, so the repertoire was really expanding, and that really caught my attention. So let's go to Gigi Grice. So Gigi Grice, I probably first heard in 1953. Probably the record that got me interested was a 10-inch Blue Note album, Howard McGhee Volume 2. Had Gigi, a very interesting band, Gigi Grice, Howard McGhee, Horace Silver, Tal Farlow of all people on guitar, Walter Bolden and Percy Heath. Very interesting sextet. And it had compositions by both McGhee and by Gigi Grice. And that really got my attention. And then there was an Art Farmer Quintet 10-inch LP on Prestige. And that had, I think, four G.G. Grice compositions. Stupendously was one. You know, just great stuff. And there was another amazing thing that fascinated me about that LP was that when Art Farmer and G.G. played fours, it was like one person on two different instruments. That's how close they were in approach to improvisation. They were both very lyrical players. They're what I call choice note players, because I don't think these guys ever played a bad note in their lives, you know. And they were compositional players. Their solos had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I, you know, that's something I kind of miss nowadays. I think, you know, without starting a big controversy, I just tend to hear, you know, and it started in the 1960s, a lot more patterns and exercise type sounding things, you know, but not these guys. These guys, Donald Byrd, I mean, Benny Golson, all these people, and then later Cannonball, you know, Sonny Stitt, you know, I mean, the list goes on and on. Sonny Rollins, of course, even early John Coltrane. These guys were just, you know, they would play a solo, and it was like a beautiful composition. You could take that, and it was just a beautiful, perfect piece of music.
You know, one of the things that makes me think about, Noel, when you talk about those differences, because I feel... I see myself in a lot of the things that you're saying, because I also began my interest in jazz, believe it or not, through the big bands and through Benny Goodman, and then I started listening to the West Coast jazz, and then the 1950s and 60s that you like so much, and which is a period that if we look at your website, we can see that you concentrate on a lot. But one of the things that I see in those records from the 1950s, from the early 60s, is that whether the musicians were better or not better than the ones we have these days, the love of melodies that these guys had was fantastic, was amazing. And I think that's one of the things that really has always attracted me about that period in jazz, is that we have the variations, we have the improvisation, we have great arrangements, but we also have this love of pure and purely beautiful melodies.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's an extremely important thing, and I totally agree that the ability to create and to play beautiful melodies is something that I don't hear that much anymore. And it's a shame, because I think even if you don't want to play in that way, if you want to go outside more, which is perfectly fine, I think the ability to master that melodic concept will inform your playing, you know, no matter what direction you want to go into. See, I view jazz as a continuum. You know, it's about 100 years old. You know, they say that it's generally felt that the first jazz recordings were made in 1917. So a lot of people think that this is the centennial of jazz. It's a very short period of time that incorporated an enormous amount of evolution in just 100 years when you think of how old classical music is, mm-hmm. which goes back centuries. You know, you look at how jazz has evolved, you know, over 100 years, it's really remarkable. But so what I like to think of is that jazz musicians have some knowledge of the entire spectrum, starting from the beginning. Now, I wouldn't expect many people coming out of the jazz studies programs of today to play in the style of the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens. You know, I wouldn't expect that. But I would like to think that the players of today have listened to the Hot Fives and the Hot Sevens and the Duke Ellington Band and the Count Basie Band of the 1930s, just to inform their playing.
Just to have knowledge about the roots, right, of the music and a sense of history. And I believe one of the things that I like about G.G. Grice, among many others, and we'll get a chance to talk about that in just a bit, but is the fact that he was a very forward-looking musician in many ways, but he also had a deep knowledge of the past of jazz, which back then was not maybe as long as it is now, all these years later, but he had a deep respect, I feel, from not just from reading your book, but also from just listening to the way he played and the albums that he made, that he really had a deep knowledge and respect for the tradition and for the history and the roots of jazz.
Absolutely. Absolutely, he did. There's an anecdote where there was an after-gig party one night, and Gigi came in, and they were playing Duke Ellington on the phonograph, you know? And then somebody came along and took Duke off and put some popular music on, and he was just totally offended, you know? So you know, Gigi definitely was somebody that had the roots during his period and respected them. And you know, on that second Jazz Lab Columbia album, they do a thing with Jackie Paris, if you're familiar with that album, that was supposed to be like a, you know, the story on that. That was something that Gigi really wanted to develop, and that was to do like a complete historical thing with the band, you know, where you actually played in the different styles. And I don't think that ever came to fruition. But yeah, I mean, he was definitely into, you know, the history of it. And the way I look at it, it's possible to play the material, even going back to the early days, by, you know, the concept I think of as old wine and new bottles. Now, there was a Gil Evans album, the beautiful, beautiful album about 1958 called Just That. And he did even Jelly Roll Morton, I think, on that album. You know, and I think that's a very interesting approach, is, you know, to actually look at some of the old music and see what you can do with it in 21st century terms. You know, there's so much out there that I think people have ignored, but this tremendous volume of compositions that were done in the 1950s is an endless source of music for people to explore. And in my work, what my little contribution to this art form is, if I can get people like Chris Byers and Carolyn Davis and Brad Lindy and some of these other people that I have had interactions with over the years, if I can just help them out and hip them to things that they might not have been aware of, there's not much more I can ask, you know, in terms of fulfillment, you know, to get the younger players, people of a generation or two generations beyond me, you know, to get interested. That's about all I can hope for.
And, you know, Noel, that's something that I also see myself reflected in, because somebody like me, who's a professor of Spanish at a university in Tennessee, and who has no musical training, I unfortunately don't have the luck of having musical training, but I have a deep love of classic jazz and music in general, but particularly jazz, which I owe to my father, really, because he is a huge record collector in all styles of music, including jazz. But I see myself reflected in that, because the reason why I write my blogs, mostly from a historical perspective, not so much a musical perspective, because my knowledge is much more limited in that respect. I do it basically not for the money or for fame or anything like that, but mostly because there's some music that I love and that I would like to be able to share with others, with like-minded people who may understand how I feel and what I think about when I listen to these albums. Whether I know whether they're playing a fifth or a seventh or whatever that is, I can't tell necessarily, but there's something that the music says to me that I try to put in words just as a way to share my love of it with other people who may be interested in it as well.
Yeah, I'm totally on board with that. And yeah, fame and fortune, forget it. You know, I mean, not going to happen. But so definitely, we do this, you know, for ourselves because we love this music, you know. And I have no problem with that. Like I say, you know, the little bit of feedback I get makes it worth it, you know. The collaborations that I've had with Chris Byers have been so fulfilling for me, you know, to be able to interact with musicians at that level, you know, is just more than I could ever, you know, ask for. So, we're dedicated people involved with music and art that really, let's face it, is ignored by most of the population. So it's a tough slog, you know, to get people interested in this. But if I get, you know, one person, that's all I can ask for. You know, I mean, it's that's what we do. So I commend you for your blog and for your efforts. We need more of that type of thing. And I spend most of my time now doing this type of research and discography and whatever. And generally, you know, I try to work on people that aren't so well known. Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is practical, you know, because certainly at this stage in my life, if I undertake Duke Ellington, you know, I'm not going to get very much accomplished. But Duke Ellington doesn't need me, doesn't need my, you know, assistance in that regard, or his legacy doesn't. So I've concentrated on these people that over the years have attracted my attention for one reason or another, generally because they were not only great soloists, but also great composers, you know, which comes back to the Gigi Grice situation, but also many of the other subjects that I've worked on, like Elmo Hope, great pianist, but also an unbelievable composer, Frank Strozier, another great player and great composer, Lucky Thompson. You know, those are the people, you know, and others that have really that really caught my attention over the years. And so if I can just, you know, get a few more people listening to their legacies, it's worth what all the time I put in on it.
You're listening to a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez. I'm talking to you from the state of Tennessee. And up in New Jersey, we have our guest today, Noel Cohen. And now, Noel, I think we should talk a little bit about your website, the Noel Cohen's Jazz History website, which can be found at Attic Toys. That's only one word, attictoys.com. And this is a website that even before I was ever in touch with you via Facebook and email and that sort of thing, I visited quite a bit. Whenever it came time to write an article about a specific album or about a specific musician that you treated, that you worked on, as you said, people like Gigi Grice, Elmo Hope, Herb Geller, Teddy Charles, Johnny Hartman, who's one of my favorite jazz singers, and for whom I've always had a very special place in my heart. Now, one of the great things you do on this website, attictoys.com, Noel Cohen's Jazz History website, is those very complete, very thorough discographies. And the discographies for me, Noel, have always been very important. When I began listening to big band jazz, and I would listen to Tommy Dorsey, for example, I used to love those, and this, I still do, those recordings Dorsey and Sinatra made together. Mm-hmm. Or Benny Goodman, or, you know, the old Duke Ellington recordings from the 30s or so, Count Basie, and so many others. You know, I would love to play the record and look at the personnel on the session and try to learn, you know, who was playing on what solo, who was playing on what year. It was almost like a baseball roster for me. I would study those names, and I would never have been able to do that without a discographer working behind the scenes and doing this so that somebody like me could actually listen to the records and put a name to a certain player. So my question about that, Noel, would be maybe twofold. How did you begin working on jazz discographies, and also how do you go about creating a jazz discography?
Yeah, okay, so I got involved in jazz discography probably around 1997. And although in the first edition of our G.G. Grice book, we did include a G.G. Grice discography, it was a little bit later that I hooked up with a gentleman named Steve Albin. Steve Albin was a computer programmer. He's retired now. But he had been contacted by the writer Will Friedwald to develop a program, a software program for doing jazz discography. And so Steve undertook this challenge and came up with something called Brian. Brian is named after the discographer Brian Rust,
the British discographer.
British discographer, correct. And Brian is now 20 years old, and over the years he's really refined it. But when he was first starting out, I hooked up with him, and the whole idea of using a database, you know, using a program that created a database, as well as, you know, allowing web displayable, you know, discography reports, that really fascinated me. Although I'm not a tech guy myself in any way, you know, but I really got hooked on this. And so in the past 20 years, I've used Brian for all my discographies, and I encourage other people to do it. I think Brian has a lot of potential. Brian has potential for musicians. I know one musician that is actually using it to keep track of his own gigs. I think teachers could use it. Mm-hmm. You know, music teachers could use it. It has, you know, a lot of possibilities. And right now there are, I think, close to 90 discographies that have been done using Brian. It's a very, very useful tool, although you have to keep in mind that Brian, you have to input the data. It's still a time-consuming project, and you still have to get things right or try to get things right. Now, one of the things about discography historically was that each of the discographers that tried to do the entire history of jazz, they would basically copy each other. And what happened was the errors got copied along too and got etched in stone.
Perpetuated,
right. So what I have tried to do is try to, you know, get things as correct as I possibly could. And that takes a lot of time. You know, so it's a huge job to do some of these things. Again, coming back to why I'm not going to do Duke Ellington, you know, because I wouldn't live long enough, you know. But G.G. Grice and Lucky Thompson, I mean, Lucky was a huge, huge, I had to divide that into three parts. I had to divide Herb Geller into two parts. Now I'm working on Art Farmer. And Art Farmer, I'm just starting out with the leader sessions, just to get something up, you know, and then I'll start on the sideman sessions. But Art Farmer had a career that spanned 50 years.
Yeah, much longer.
And that's a lot for me, you know, so that's going to be a huge job. But were it not for Brian, I would not have done all of these things. And you'll see that my discography reports have a similarity because they were all done in the same way. Continuity, whatever you want to say. It's a program I highly recommend. It can be accessed at jazzdiscography.com. It's free, and it's available for Windows or Mac users. So if anybody out there is interested in doing discography, which I don't, but you never know, I would encourage them to start out with this Brian software because it's really excellent, and it creates a database. That's a beautiful thing. If you just do a Word document, you know, that's just, you know, something that isn't that useful. But when you have a database that has thousands of entries of, you know, data pieces of composers, songs, musicians, you know, sessions, mm-hmm. issues, albums, you know, it's a much more useful thing. And it also makes expedite your work because, you know, if you have Art Farmer in there, you can just call him up. You don't have to, you know, type the name in every time, at least not the full name. You know, so this is the way to go, I think, in the 21st century with regard to discography.
Now, besides this Brian software, Noel, right. How do you go about collecting all the data that you need to feed this Brian software? What kind of materials do you use? What kind of thought process, so to speak, goes into making a good discography, a professional, thorough discography like the ones that you have up online?
There are a number of sources, not the least of which is my own record collection, mm-hmm. which is a basic starting point, although in none of my cases, none of the cases of the people that I, whose discographies I did I have only, you know, but a small fraction of their, you know, overall legacy. But it's a starting point, and mm-hmm. it's very convenient because it's right here in my office. Besides that, I've accessed the Institute of Jazz Studies located at the Rutgers University campus in Newark, New Jersey, about 7 miles from me. So I go down there a lot. They have a huge collection of recordings, but also all kinds of other, you know, archival material. So that's another excellent source of data. And the existing discographies that I mentioned, flawed though they may be, are still a very useful starting point. You know, they're not an end point, but they're a starting point to see what else, you know, is out there. And I have a subscription to Tom Lord's The Jazz Discography. I have the online version, which is very useful for, you know, finding, for example, the overall picture of a given musician, you know, what they've done, because it is very complete. There are errors in there, so it's not the final word, but it's a good overview of a musician's recorded history. Now, in my discographies, I include more than just recordings or authorized recordings. I include also live recordings that people have recorded, you know, generally without authorization. But I think it's an important part of the history of any musician to get as much of that information as possible. So, you know, maybe the term discography is a misnomer. Maybe what I do might better be called sessionography mm-hmm. because it includes things, you know, many things that were never meant to be recorded and issued, you know, on a disc or, you know, whatever. There are all sorts of, you know, websites, All Music is often a good source of getting information on issues. Discogs.com is another excellent website, you know, which has a lot of information, particularly album art and also album issue date. They have a lot of issue dates, which often are very hard to find.
And also all over the world, too. If there is a, if there's a, an edition in Japan or an edition in Europe, not just like the American ones, but also editions all over the world, and you can find that information there. So that's that's also very, very good. Now, when you work on a discography, besides the fact that there will be errors here and there, and it may be hard to ascertain where the errors lie, perhaps, what are the main difficulties that you face when you're trying to create a thorough discography or sessionography like yours?
Yeah, well, there's the biggest frustration are the answers that can never be found. Recording dates that were never recorded and can no longer be retrieved. So one has to guess, you know, make intelligent guesses in some cases. And I hate to do that, but I often have no alternative. And there's a lot of that, unfortunately. This music was not well documented, and I think even now musicians do not pay enough attention to documenting, you know, their own recorded history. I have done discographies of a couple of living people who are my friends. Vibraphonist Joe Locke and saxophonist Bob Mover. They have often been very helpful, you know, with recording dates and other personnel, you know, other pieces of information. But that's kind of the exception, I have to say, is that people just don't write down, you know, the specifics of a recording session.
Do you think,
I'm amazed at that.
Do you think that is maybe because when these sessions were made, a lot of the people involved, the participants and the people who were recording and maybe keeping track of stuff, maybe they did not have a sense of the historical value that those recordings
had? Absolutely. Sure. That's one of the things. And the other thing is people, especially nowadays, are running around like crazy. I mean, you know, they're busy people, you know, and they just don't have the time, you know, to do this. Now, even in the old days, there were certain musicians like Milt Hinton was one, and Eddie Burt was another. I think Bud Shank also. These guys were noted for keeping, you know, little logbooks of their gigs, you know, which, you know, could be invaluable. You know, I know that Milt Hinton's, it might be at Duke University, I'm not sure. But those kind of things, those are treasures, you know, but was seldom done. I mean, certainly in the old days, you know, sad to say, a lot of the musicians had substance abuse problems and, you know, recording who they just did a, you know, a session with was not their prime, that was not their priority. They just wanted the money for the session and to get out of there and purchase whatever they had to purchase. Very sad situation.
It's sometimes funny to think, Noel, that within the big band, the big bands at least, you know, in the 1930s, early 40s, sometimes it was the lesser known, less important musicians within the band that kept his records.
Right.
So maybe it wasn't Buddy Rich or it wasn't Babe Russin, but it was somebody else who was just a sideman, not as good as they were, who did somehow have a certain, I don't know, maybe admiration for the kind of music that he was playing at the same time as being a part of it, and did have this historical sense that something important was being made.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And you have to remember also that the big bands would be playing like every night. They'd get on a bus and go to another destination. And I mean, that's a crazy life, you know. I mean, lucky to get any sleep and food, you know, let alone keeping a record of, you know, all these details. So, yeah, so it's probably, realistically, it's probably too much to ask. But there are a lot of problems. I mean, the data acquisition is a big problem, you know, especially, you know, on sessions that go back many years and, you know, records may have been lost in a fire or something and are just no longer retrievable. That's a huge, you know, source of frustration. You know, we try, you know, I try as much as I can, you know, to get as much information as I can from whatever sources. You know, it's really very difficult. Union, Musicians Union, New York, LA. New York, I don't think they kept them, you know, the records of the contract and so forth. Los Angeles, I've been told that there's one person who has a waiting list of people wanting to have him look up, you know, sessions. I have been helped by that source from time to time with West Coast sessions, but, you know, it's not a ongoing source of information. But anything like that, wow, you know, I mean, it's a huge thing. It's really tough. That I think is the biggest problem, is getting the data and getting it accurate and specific as much as possible.
You're listening to a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez, and up in, is it upstate New Jersey? Or
it's northern New Jersey.
New Jersey. We have Noel Cohen, who has done extensive work as a discographer, researcher. He's a record collector, a jazz historian, and it's our pleasure to have him on this episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. Now, in my hand right here, I have this book, which is already in its second edition. It was written by Noel Cohen and his friend Michael Fitzgerald, and the title.
Yeah, and it's. Let me just say that it's very important to acknowledge Michael Fitzgerald. I couldn't have done that without him, and so I mean, at this point in time, I have more free time than he does, so I seem to be getting more opportunities. But he certainly made, you know, major contributions to that book, and at that point in time, when the book was written, I certainly couldn't have done, you know, come up with something like that without his assistance.
Tell us a little about him. Tell us a little bit about Michael Fitzgerald.
Yeah,
who is he?
Mike Fitzgerald has degrees from both the Rutgers Jazz Studies program and the Jazz History Master's program. And then he went down to the University of North Carolina and got a degree in library science. So when I first met him, he was a school teacher teaching in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. He's now a librarian at the University of the District of Columbia in D.C., he's a very, very capable guy, very, very knowledgeable about jazz history. And there's actually, I think, on YouTube right now, a very excellent interview of him with Bob Porter, the jazz producer, that happened recently down at UDC, I believe. But Mike is very, very knowledgeable about, you know, many aspects of this music, and you know, like I say, I could absolutely not have done you know, something as detailed as that without his collaboration.
Well, we do definitely thank him and commend him for that. And the book I have in my hand is called Rat Race Blues: The Musical Life of G.G. Grice, and it's been published in Rockville, Maryland, by Current Research in Jazz. And as I said before, it's in its second edition already. And it's a book that you co-authored with Michael. And how did this project come about? Why G.G. Grise? Why did you sit down and think, I'm going to write this book about G.G. Grise? And then, you know, how did it happen?
Okay, so it goes back actually again to my, as I was saying before, about when I first heard G.G. on that Howard McGhee record, then the Art Farmer record, then his own records. And he just caught my attention with his lyrical playing and also with the great tunes that he wrote. Nika's Tempo, you know, just all of those tunes, Wildwood, Shabazz, Minority, Stupendous Lee. I mean, they were just great tunes. And some of them very unusual structures and so forth. And that stayed with me. But I had almost all of those early records, the Jazz Lab, all of them, the one on Riverside, the two on Columbia. The French RCA I never had because that was a really rare record. But I had almost everything G.G. recorded. And then the stuff with the Oscar Pettiford band, you know, the music just stayed with me. And then many, many years later, probably in the mid-90s, when I was trying to play now down in the New York metropolitan area, I would go to these jam sessions and bring some transcriptions that I had done of G.G.'s tunes. And everybody liked playing them. And one night somebody said, you know, you should do a book of G.G. Grise's tunes. So I got to thinking about that, and, you know, I think what this person was thinking of was one of these illegal fake book, as they're called, type things, but I wanted to do it right, you know, so I thought that, okay, my initial goal was to do a book of lead sheets of most of Grise's recorded tunes with a discography in the front and some, you know, historical information about him as an introduction. So for a long time, I tried to acquire the rights to do that from G.G.'s sister and nephew in Hartford, Connecticut. G.G. by that time was long gone. He had passed away in 1983, but there still existed a publishing company that controlled the rights. But that, make a long story short, that never panned out for a variety of reasons. But by that time, I had done a lot of research on him that I didn't want to see go to waste. So one night talking to Michael Fitzgerald, who I had met, I think probably at the Institute of Jazz Studies, they have monthly roundtables during the, you know, semesters that school is in session. And I think that's where I met Mike as I look back on it. And we got to talking about this, and he showed interest in collaborating on this. And so that was really the start of Rat Race Blues, The Musical Life of G.G. Grise. So we started doing in-depth research. And what we did was we based the book on interviews. So using the discography, we selected a number of individuals that we thought would be useful ones to interview. So we made a list of people, and we found out how to contact them. And because of the fact that Mike was a full-time teacher and I was retired, I did most of the interviews. And I think I ended up doing over 80 of them altogether, mostly telephone interviews. And as you can see in the book, it was relatives, fellow musicians, record producers, you know, a number of different sources. most of which were fruitful interviews. Actually, the ones that were disappointing were some of the more famous musicians who either refused to be interviewed or were very, very general in their responses. On the other hand, there were people like a pianist named Emery Smith in Hartford, Connecticut, who remembered intimate details of how Gigi and a trumpet player from Hartford would practice, how they would sight read out of each other's books. You know, I mean, that kind of stuff, you can't, you know, if you find details like that, it's a blessing, you know, for a project like this. So you never know what you're going to find. I also learned an important lesson. Never question what your interviewee is telling you. Never question it. You let the interview be done, then you sort out what's fact and what's fiction. But don't take someone that is giving their time to you. Don't question whether they're accurate or not, or truthful or not. That's not the place to do it. So I learned that the hard way.
That's a very valuable advice, really. That really is.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't think about that, and you come in thinking, well, I know everything about the subject. I've read all the books there are to read. And then, you know, that must be a very disrespectful thing to do to somebody who is trying to remember something.
And most of the time, it's not somebody being untruthful. It just, you know, generally people conflating times and events, you know, and things like that. And that's my job. Then you go back and you sort that out, but you don't do it during the interview.
It's just the way memory works after all.
Right. The other problem that one has is that I got the feeling that some of the people who, let's face it, were more famous, ended up, you know, more famous than Gigi was, might have been a little insulted, you know, that I was asking them about Gigi and not about themselves. And I learned that, so I would, you know, ask them, you know, if they could give me some background on themselves, you know, to try to overcome that barrier, so to speak. So interviewing was an interesting process, one that I, before every interview, I had butterflies in my stomach. I never knew, you know, what was going to happen, what kind of a response I might get. Generally, they were positive. Sometimes they were hostile. You just have to be prepared for that. But the book, as you've seen, is largely based on these interviews, which we generally didn't edit very much. And you know, they're the words with the profanity, whatever, you know, as it came out of their mouths.
And that's one of the things I really like about this book that makes the book so readable and really quite a page-turner for anyone interested in good classic jazz music, is the fact that it is a little bit like an oral history if you think about it. There's this polyphony of voices that you arrange in such a way that it makes the book really interesting and very readable, and also very informative about not just Gigi Grise, but also the historical, the social, the musical context. And I think that's very important. What I like about the book, Noel, if I can be frank with you, is that, but also the fact that the book really is a musical life of Gigi Grise. I'm happy about when I read the book, and I've read it a couple of times already. About the fact that you're talking about his life, but also about his music. Not just his life or just his music. And I like books that kind of conflate those two sides, because if we are interested in the music of Gigi Grise, it's because of his life. If we are interested in his life, it's because of his music. It all ends up being one and the same thing, or at least part of the same thing, don't you think?
I totally appreciate everything you just said. And yes, I think one of the problems, for example, with movies that are made about jazz musicians is that they tend to, for dramatic effect, spend too much time with drugs and personal problems and divorce and tragedy. And you know, when you get down to it, this is music. It's not, it's people making music, but it's the music that is the art, you know? And so I feel that that's the really important thing to concentrate. And the other things are interesting as they might inform the music of these people, you know, the background of how they might play in a certain way or why they might write songs in a certain way. You know, that's certainly important. But to me, the music is the central piece of this type of biography. And I will never write anything that's, you know, totally just personal, you know, anecdotes and stuff that might, I'd probably get a lot more hits, you know, if I wrote something that was really, what should I say, racy and plays up all the personal problems. And but that's not where I'm at. I mean, I'm interested in the music. It's the music that got me hooked, and it's the music that still is to me the focal point of everything that I do.
Particularly when you're talking about a subject that you didn't really meet in person.
Exactly. I never met him. Now, that's an interesting thing. A lot of great players came through Rochester when I was living there in those golden days. But Gigi was not one of them, because Gigi didn't like to travel. He, and especially after Clifford Brown was killed in that horrible, his good friend, you know, was killed in that horrible accident in 1956. So he was very New York centric, you know, and so in those days I didn't travel much myself. So if they didn't come through Rochester, and I heard some great music in Rochester. I heard the Miles Band with Train and Red Garland, Philly Joe, Paul Chambers. Mm-hmm. I heard Sonny Rollins twice, once with the Clifford Brown, Max Roach Quintet, and later with the trio with Henry Grimes and Frankie Dunlop. I heard Billie Holiday. I heard Terry Gibbs. You know, these people all, Ray Bryant, the Three Sounds. I was hanging out, you know, and underage a lot of the time, you know. That was an important part of my life.
You were in the right place, too.
Yeah. I mean, Rochester, it was on the circuit, you know. It was on the circuit, not just for the big concert tours, but also for the individual tours, you know. So, in fact, on my website, I've got, you know, a section devoted to Rochester, at least for a few of those years that when I lived there, you know, I've tried to document by going back, going to the library up there and looking at the ads, you know, for all the clubs, you know, and trying to document a lot of these experiences I had, you know, right down to the actual date, you know, when the person came through. And that's important information for historians. I just yesterday or the day before helped a Sonny Rollins historian, you know, with regard to those gigs that he played in Rochester, you know. So, but I heard a lot of music up there. Wow. And I got to play, you know, with some great people. I got to play with Ron Carter. Ron Carter was a bassist in the Rochester Philharmonic and a student at the Eastman School of Music. When I was an undergraduate at the University of Rochester, and we graduated in the same ceremony, and he was, I think, immediately off to Chico Hamilton. I think that was his first, you know, name gig was Chico Hamilton. But I played with the great Joe Romano, a great, not so well known tenor saxophonist from Syracuse, was Sal Nistico. From Buffalo was Don Menza and Sam Noto. You know, also from Rochester, Frank Strazzeri, great piano player who moved out to the West Coast. So I had some great experiences, even though, in all honesty, I was at a much lower level than a lot of these people. Oh, Wayman Reed, another one, a great trumpet player that played with Basie's band and was married to Sarah Vaughan for a while, and then played with James Brown. Oh, James Brown, I'm forgetting Pee-wee Ellis. Ooh. I played with Pee-wee Ellis when Pee-wee Ellis was he might have been 14 or 15, you know, at the time. And I played in Pee-wee Ellis's, it was sort of a rhythm and blues band, you know, probably around 1956. And he went on to fame and fortune. So I had some great experiences up there. Yeah, Rochester was happening.
You're listening to a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez, and we have Noel Cohen up in New Jersey talking to me and talking to everyone out there, reminiscing about his life, his career, and his love of jazz music. This episode will be available on iTunes and also on YouTube, and of course in the Jazz Flashes blog at jazzflashes.blogspot.com. Now let's talk a little bit about Gigi Grice. Okay. You know, the subject of this book, Rat Race Blues, the musical life of Gigi Grice, that Noel has written along with his friend Michael Fitzgerald, and it's already in its second edition. In fact, I have a copy of the second edition right here in my hand. Now, Gigi Grice, well, you've already talked a little bit about what attracted you about his style, his music, you know, his compositions, and that sort of thing. Now, Gigi Grice, of course, in order to get the whole picture of who Gigi Grice was and how important he was, I recommend that everyone out there go out, buy or borrow or whatever, but read this book, Rat Race Blues. But Gigi Grice was from Pensacola, Florida, right? And in that way, he was a little bit like you, in that he was in a place where he got the chance to listen to a lot of great, great music that just was part of the circuit, so to speak. And a lot of the big bands went to Pensacola and played there, just in a similar way as, you know, where you were living, Rochester. It had an important jazz scene. Now, he was there at the time, you know, when, you know, bebop was being born, so to speak, right?
Right.
And then later on, you know, would make recordings with some really important musicians,
sure,
in that idiom. But who would you say were the biggest influences on the music of Gigi Grice, early on at least? Who was he listening to? What kind of music was he drawn to that made up the style that he little by little started developing?
I would have to say Charlie Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Although he himself would mention, and I won't remember their names, unfortunately, but when he was in the service, he was in the service from 1944 to 1946, and he was stationed in Chicago for a while, north of Chicago, at the Great Lakes, the famous Great Lakes Naval Station, where a whole lot of musicians passed through during the war and after the war. But he was listening to players in the Chicago area that he mentioned, and like I said, I'm spacing the names at the moment, but I would say Charlie Parker and Tommy Grice, Gigi's brother,
mm-hmm,
who lives here in New Jersey. He told me and he's a few years younger than Gigi. I mean, it was those, you know, early bebop 78 records like Salt Peanuts, you know, they'd never heard anything like that before, you know. So, you know, I tend to think that already, see, by 1944, and Gigi would only have been about 18, you know, or so around that time, 18 or 19, bebop was already, you know, starting to come into play. So I would think, and also from listening to his style, which, by the way, all right, let me say this about Gigi. I think if you ask most people to list the 10 most influential alto saxophonists, Gigi's name won't be among them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's unreasonable. On the other hand, Gigi had a recognizable style. and approach. I can hear Gigi on a recording. And that to me is a very important, a very admirable quality, which is something that in that era was absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. That's what the whole thing was about. Not playing patterns that you learned in school, but creating your own identity as a player by incorporating the influences of people like Bird and Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young and whoever, but getting your own sound, you know. And so, you know, you had in the 1950s another great aspect of that period. You had these people that were so recognizable. You hear four bars, you knew who they were. You know, I'm not so sure that's true nowadays as well as people play. I'm not so sure I hear that type of originality in approach, although they're absolutely wonderful players. But Gigi, you know, certainly would never make the top 10 list of alto saxophonists. But he did have his thing, you know. But when you take the package of Gigi the player, Gigi the composer, Gigi the arranger, mm-hmm. now I think you've got a very important player for at least around 10 years or so on the New York scene. And that's another thing about him. He was only around for 10 years. His friend Art Farmer, as I said, was around for half a century playing, you know, as a player, you know. So Gigi disappeared, you know, and, you know, out of sight, out of mind. He's, you know, that had a lot to do with him not, mm-hmm. you know, being so well known. But, you know, let me say this. In the 1950s, when Gigi was in New York City, he was right in the thick of things. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. In retrospect, he pales in, you know, legacy to a to a Cannonball Adderley or a Jackie McLean or you know, a Sonny Stitt, who were around for much longer than mm-hmm. he was, you know. But he was right in the thick of things at the time, you know. So it's a fascinating story. It's a sad one in the sense that, you know, I mean, it would be fascinating to know what Gigi would have done if he had continued to play through the 60s and 70s and 80s, you know, how he would have evolved. He could have done all sorts of things. He could have gone to Hollywood. Could have done TV, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, had all the tools, you know, to do that kind of thing. So, but unfortunately, he chose to drop out, and that legacy is not as substantial as it could have been.
Well, of course, in this era of technology, the reason why we can talk about the past and the history of jazz is the fact that there are recordings, right? Thanks to those recordings, we can gain some knowledge about the history and the tradition of jazz, the different styles, the different people that played together, and that sort of thing. But by the same token, if you don't record too much, then your legacy could be diminished in a way that may be unfair, because if you think about it, there were probably or surely a lot of musicians that followed Gigi Kreis that were influenced by him. But because he didn't really get to record, or he chose not to record after the early 1960s, his legacy is diminished. And that is why I think a book like Rat Race Blues is important as well, to kind of not necessarily set the record straight, but at least, you know, bring to prominence the image and the figure of Gigi Kreis.
Yeah, when you look at Gigi's, the people that play trumpet in his bands, who do you have? Clifford Brown, Art Farmer, Donald Byrd, Idris Suleiman, Richard Williams. You know, I mean, they're there. Those are the top players. Who did he use as rhythm section people? Hank Jones, Wade Leggy, you know, Tommy Flanagan. You know, all the very best people. He was right in the thick of it. He's in A Great Day in Harlem. He's in that photo, A Great Day in Harlem. He's way on the left as you look at the photo, right? He brought Thelonious Monk to that photo shoot. They were very close, you know. So Gigi was he lent Bird his horn, you know, but he went along to the gig to make sure he got it back. But you know, so Gigi was at the time highly respected.
Now, you have talked a little bit about Gigi Grice, the performer, the altoist, the actual musician, as far as the performance side of things goes. How about Gigi Grice as a composer? If I were to ask you to describe him as a composer, what would you say? What was important? Well, what was characteristic about his composing?
Let's go back to what you said about melody. Beautiful melodies, you know, things that you can whistle or hum, you know, and you know, I think the progenitor of that school of composers was probably Tad Dameron.
Absolutely.
You know, and people like Gigi and Benny Golson, you know, well, they played at Tad's band in 1953, but I think they openly admitted, you know, being influenced by Tad. But it's melody. Now, Gigi wrote songs with unusual structures, like Evening in Casablanca, which has a structure of 46 bars, but 10, 14, 8, 10, I think it is. Very unusual, beautiful ballad, very exotic. Nika's Tempo is a 44-bar structure with 12-bar phrases that aren't the blues, you know. Things like that, you know, are really interesting. And like I said, they exploded the repertoire in the 1950s. There was all these songs. Randy Weston was another one who wrote, you know, just beautiful melodies. And Benny Golson, of course. You know, so that I think is what I would say. It's melody.
You also point out in the book something that I think is quite interesting and that we don't always think about, is that he kind of stayed away, Gigi Grice stayed away from this idea of theme, solos, and theme. Right?
Exactly.
He tried to write compositions that were a little bit more complex than that.
Right.
After reading that, I kind of went back and listened to the records again. And you're absolutely right about that. And it's a very interesting thing to think about, that he was trying to look forward in that way, trying to write something different that would, you know, allow for a different kind of improvisation, perhaps.
Yeah, see, what they would do also in that period, it was not just the jazz lab, but other groups like Clifford Brown, Max Roach, the Art Blakey, Jazz Messengers, of course, the Horace Silver Quintet, they're all like writing interludes, you know, nice arrangements. It wasn't just, like you say, you know, head, solos, head. They would introduce you know, interludes and shout choruses as well, you know. So, yeah, that was definitely a part of the 1950s and early 60s. Wayne Shorter, even. I mean, you know, Gigi wrote a tune called Up in Quincy's Room. And that tune kind of foreshadows Maiden Voyage, you know, like, a dozen years later, Herbie Hancock, the harmonic movement in that tune, you know. So yeah, I mean, it wasn't earth shaking, and it was still accessible, you know. It wasn't like out in any way, but it was different, and it added structure to the performances. Absolutely.
And it was really attractive in that way. Now, one of the things about Gigi Grice is that he was conservatory trained, and he overcame the years of poverty of his childhood, or not necessarily poverty, but well, it could, I'm not sure if I would use the word poverty, but at least, you know, it definitely his family was not rich, and his father
was it was poverty,
and so we can use the word poverty then, but he overcame that. And he got a very significant education, just like the rest of his siblings as well. And then went on to have a career in music that was conservatory trained. Now, how do you think that maybe helped or perhaps hindered his career as a jazz musician or a jazz composer? Do you think that was a very positive thing or maybe a not so positive thing for a jazz musician like him to be conservatory trained? This is a question that I also asked Chris Byers about a couple of weeks ago. The fact that Gigi Grice was conservatory trained, was that, let's say, a positive thing or maybe a problem when it came to being a jazz musician and a jazz composer?
I think overall it was probably a positive thing, but I'm sure there were a number of musicians who, well, I think Monk at one point said to Gigi, "Don't let the conservatory guys spoil you." You know, something like that. That's paraphrasing, you know, but something to that effect. Don't let the conservatory corrupt you. You know, be what you are. You know, don't forget your roots. You know. But certainly in practical terms, the conservatory training was extremely helpful to him and allowed him to be a great writer, a great arranger. You know, he had the tools. I mean, a lot of his, you know, I mean, people like Cannonball Adderley and Jackie McLean and Sonny Stitt, who are, you know, probably more acclaimed as alto players, they weren't arrangers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so sure. I mean, Gigi, he had the ability to arrange because of the training he got there. And Gigi also, he took advantage. I mean, in school, he benefited from FDR's programs because they were what paid for the music teachers that initially taught him and created the programs that allowed him to learn how to play the clarinet. Then, having served in the military, he used the GI Bill in order to get a college education. You know, so that was, you know, very clever, you know, use of resources that were available to him through the government. I know that type of thing. In the 2012 election, people like that were Romney called users, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But those programs were incredibly valuable to people that didn't have means.
Well, it's something important to think about, especially in this day and age when we're talking continuously. The government is talking about cutting, and all
exactly.
That cutting has always or very often to do with the humanities and the arts.
Right.
So, you know, in many ways, thanks to the use of those resources, which of course were used in the right way by
sure.
Gigi, he was able to become what he became in his life as a performer, as an arranger, as a composer, and then as a teacher as well. Now, I was looking
right.
here for a quotation from the book about what Gigi Grice once said when he was asked about the relationship between classical music and jazz music. And I think it's pretty interesting what he says. He says, "I don't feel that my knowledge of European writing techniques has influenced my jazz writing. I do feel that it has played an important part in helping me to analyze the chords, rhythms, etc. that I hear while studying a new piece of music, either classical or jazz." And then he says, "My academic background has also helped considerably in writing for a large orchestra rhythmically and contrapuntally." So that is basically what
yeah.
you're saying. But do,
yeah, exactly.
but do
yeah.
you think it's true that there is really no relationship between the classical music that he heard and he liked and the jazz music he composed?
Well, I mean, the harmonies, I mean, certainly at least tonal classical music, I mean, you're dealing with the same scales, you know, the same harmonies and so forth. But so, you know, in purely technical terms, knowledge of harmony and theory are usable in any kind of music. But there's no question that Gigi's training set him apart, you know, from a lot, like I said, a lot of the other, you know, better recognized alto players or saxophonists. There's no question that this gave him tools, you know, that he wouldn't have had he not gone to the conservatory. This guy, I think it's very sad that he dropped out, because I just think that he had all kinds of doors open to him, and he didn't have the personal problems, you know, the drug problems and other things, smoking. He didn't do any of those things, drinking, you know. So he could have had a substantial career in many different areas, you know.
He never came to pass. He seems to have been a very healthy person, a very reasonable person too.
Well, except that he died young. He died at the same age as his father. So, you know, the genetics, mm-hmm. you know, you can't do anything about that. But he certainly, he didn't smoke, he didn't drink. He certainly tried. You know, but you can't overcome genetics.
You're listening to a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. I'm Anton Garcia Fernandez, and up in New Jersey, we have researcher, discographer, record collector, Noel Cohen, and we're talking with Noel about Gigi Grice because, among many other things, because he has published a book called Rat Race Blues, The Musical Life of Gigi Grice, along with his colleague and friend Michael Fitzgerald. Now, Gigi Grice made some memorable records with the likes of Clifford Brown and Donald Byrd, Art Farmer, Richard Williams, a lot of different great musicians of the period. He also co-led the Jazz Lab, as you've mentioned
right.
before, for a spell with Donald Byrd. But he only recorded, as we have already mentioned, for less than a decade, right? Just between
right.
1953 and 1961, so just about a decade or so. Why such a short recording career? Could you tell us a little bit, without going too much into detail, because that's what the book is there for, but
right.
why would somebody who was as talented, as well-respected as well within the New York jazz scene, as Gigi Grice was, why would somebody like that drop out completely and devote himself to teaching after the early 1960s?
Well, in 1955, Gigi started his first publishing company. In 1958, he added another one. Now, he was very much about composers protecting their own works. So was Horace Silver, by the way, and Hank Jones and his brothers, Lucky Thompson. So he was not unique in worrying about things like that. But what Gigi did was he started a publishing company that published not only his own songs, but those of many other, almost all African-American composers. That was not taken too well by record companies,
mm-hmm.
at least certain record companies. Now, this was an area that was very hard to research. And so we never really got a solid answers as to what exactly happened. But but the picture we were able to put together was that as time went on, these record companies were telling the musicians that if you wanted to record your tune, you couldn't publish it with G.G. Grice's companies. Because they wanted to get the royalties or part of the royalties. So that's what they were telling musicians, Bobby Timmons, who had Monin, you know, which was getting recorded quite a bit. So that's what they were saying is, you know, if you want to record your songs, he can't be publishing them. So the musicians were coming to Gigi and taking their songs out of his publishing companies. And this frustrated and hurt Gigi. And there may even have been some intimidation. Now, we heard all kinds of horror stories about his house being firebombed and him being beat up and things like that. We couldn't find any proof of anything like that. But certainly what was going on, and when you think about it, that wasn't really necessary, you know, because what the record companies were doing was just as effective. They didn't have to resort to violence, you know. So those were just rumors that mushroomed, you know. So by the early 1960s, he was having a lot of problem, you know, with this. And also, I think they were ignoring paying Gigi royalties, paying Gigi's company's royalties. So he was getting it from both ends. He had musicians calling him up at all hours of the day and night, you know, where's my royalties? Where's my money? You know, and he had the record companies not paying the royalties, you know, saying basically, sue me, you know, come after me, get a lawyer and come after me. And I think after a while, it just got to be too much for him. He, you know, had a history of, he says, I had a nervous breakdown, you know, in the early 1950s. So this was not a guy with a very thick skin. And I think that by, we know that in 1963, because we've seen the letter, a sample of the letters he sent out to the remaining composers in his publishing companies, that I'm returning your music to you. And that same year, 1963, he becomes a substitute teacher in the New York school system and stops using the name G.G. Grice. So I think, in answer to your question, I think the main reason for him dropping out of being a performer, an active musician, and becoming a teacher had to do with the upshot of his publishing companies.
So it was more of a an administrative thing, really. It was more because of the administrative side of the music business than it was due to the let's say artistic side of it. Do you think?
Yeah. I would say it went a little further than that. I think there was racism involved, you know, because they had been exploiting the black musicians left and right all along. It just went with the territory. And it was that Gigi was trying to put a stop to. So there was a lot more than just, you know, looking at it from an administrative perspective. Although Gigi wasn't a, you know, a civil rights activist, let's say, I think what he was trying to do for black composers was very important to him.
Very pioneering in that way, too.
I'm sorry?
Very pioneering in that way, too.
Pioneering, yes, absolutely. Yes, and risky. And he paid the price. You know, so I think that really got to him. And it just made him he was afraid. He was afraid of the consequences of what might happen. I think people probably were saying things to him, "You better watch out, man. You know, they're going to get you." And he, you know, we have some, you know, in the book, some stories from his wife about how he became paranoid about people coming after him, you know, and we could never verify anything like that. But he definitely was acting scared, you know, like there were people actually threatening him and his family. Maybe it was true. His wife denied anything like that. So that's still an open question. Excuse me, sorry about that.
That's certainly no problem at all.
In fact, let me squelch this thing. I should have done that in the first place. So I think it was not just, you know, the practical side of the composers, you know, pulling out, that type of thing. I think it was very demoralizing to him to see this kind of a dream, you know, go down the drain.
And interestingly, Noel, he seems to have actually dropped out around the time when jazz musicians in the jazz world was about to become much more openly political.
Yes.
So he didn't actually get a chance to participate in that sort of movement, which I found interesting. And that's why the word pioneering came to mind, because he was doing something ahead of his time, but then he didn't really get a chance to follow up or follow through once jazz became more overtly political. At least some of the African-American musicians were.
Yeah. Now, his work as a teacher was, again, not overtly as a civil rights activist, but in his ability to work with kids that were at risk in a way that practically nobody else, at least at the time, at these schools, other faculty members were able to do, you know, was another, you know, serving as a role model. Actually, one of his students pointed out to me that in the 1970s even, there were very few black teachers, you know. So he stood out, you know, with these kids. And the stories I got was he could run an assembly and you could hear a pin drop. And the other teachers, it was utter chaos. So he had an amazing ability, you know, coupled with the racial thing going on, to really, you know, be a leader as an educator as well, but not like marching in the streets or anything like that. You know, he just did it on the job, you know, and we got these stories. In the first edition, we hadn't found any of his students. The second edition, we were able to interview some of his students, and it was amazing what a role model this guy was, you know, for these kids at a time when they had nobody.
Well, there's obviously different ways to make a difference in that way. You know, one could be more public when one marches or is actively participating in things that appear in the media and you know, writes books or gives speeches. But then there's also the less visible way of making a difference, which I think it looks like that's the one that Gigi Grice took. He definitely had a certain love of teaching. It looks like he did it out of necessity, but at the same time, he did have a love of teaching. Where would that come from, do you think?
I don't know, but here's an interesting thing. All of his siblings were teachers. All the kids, all the Grice kids, there were six of them. Every one of them became a teacher at one point. So, I don't know. I if it was something that his mother instilled in them, if it was something that came perhaps from the church, which was very important in his early upbringing, although he became a Muslim, and actually fairly early on in his life. But, you know, it's hard to say, but I will say this, that I think Gigi probably would have had, you know, at least a happier life had he gone into teaching in the first place. Mm-hmm. He was clearly gifted in that way, and although he was a great musician, you know, he, you know, might have had a happier, you know, and less stressful life than the New York music scene.
Well, though one might think, Noel, that it's maybe a sadder part of the book because he has, at that point, relinquished any musical activities as a recording artist or as a live performer or that sort of thing. To me, that part of the book that deals with his teaching is fascinating from the point of view of somebody like myself, who's a college professor. It is really a part of the book that I find extremely interesting, and how much of himself he gave to the community, how much of himself he gave to those kids that he taught. One of the interesting things also about his life, if I may have a little time to ask you about this, is, and it, this almost seems to be on the brink of becoming a taboo in this country these days, but I'm going to ask you about this anyway. You did mention his church upbringing and then his conversion to Islam, and that's where the taboo comes in. What was the reason behind this attraction that Islam had for Gigi Grice, who took on the name of Bashir Qusim? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that well, but
I think that's probably right. Okay.
Why did he do that? Did you find in the course of your research any reasons behind this conversion, or was it just something that is still, let's say, a dark point in his life where we don't know exactly why?
I never was able to get an answer to that. But you have to keep in mind that he was not the only one that converted to Islam. There was Sahib Shahab, Idris Suleiman, Art Blakey, you know. So, you know, there were many before him.
And then other people in other fields, too, that did so, not just jazz musicians, but yes.
Sure. I mean, it is, you know, worldwide a huge, you know, very influential religion. Maybe it was the exoticism. I just don't know. I never really got a good answer to that. That would have been a question I would like to ask him. But the sisters and brother didn't really have an answer to that. It was just something he did, and then they found out about it. So it's hard to say.
Now, he does have a public school named after himself.
Yes. The interesting thing is that very few people, if any, during all the years, you have to remember that he was a teacher for twice as long as he was a musician. And very few, if any, people knew that he was Gigi Grice when he was teaching. The only ones that knew were, he had a couple of musicians come and assist him with the students. One was that piano player that had played with Louis Armstrong, and there were a couple others who knew who Gigi Grice was. But even when we got to go over to PS 53, there's a plaque in the entranceway that says it's a Gigi Grice Bashir Qusim school, but nobody there really knew anything about this or really cared, to be very honest.
You mean in the present day, like right now?
Yeah. This was like in 2000. Mm-hmm. There was not much interest or curiosity about who this guy was. Although after the book came out, I think there was some more. But it was just amazing how he just, you know, basically was hiding in plain sight, you know, not even under another, well, it was under another identity, but basically just his Muslim name, you know, not really an alias. So, it's really an amazing story. But, the school was renamed after he died in 1983. And, you know, they discovered who he was. And, you know, it was not something that was known at all. And it just amazed me. Nobody that we interviewed knew about the school, you know, on the musical side of it. Nobody knew about the teaching side. I mean, this was a stark break that he made in his life, where he really cut those musical years off from the teaching years.
So the change in name might have helped, but there's also an attitude that he had, right, possibly, of not talking about his past as a recording artist.
Right, absolutely. It was really amazing to me. I would really have loved to meet this guy. You know, I don't know how forthcoming he would have been, but I've, you know, tried to create how I think he was, you know, soft-spoken, although I've heard him on, you know, there's this Uptown, single CD that came out about 2008 that we wrote the liner notes for, that has live Gigi, and you can hear him introducing, you know, tunes at Birdland. There's not much Gigi's voice on record, you know. But I've, over the years, tried to put a personality to this character that I worked on, you know, and I have my own idea of what he would have been like, but I don't, you know, you never know for sure. I would have loved to meet him.
Well, I certainly would have too myself. He really, after, you know, reading the book, he emerges as a very interesting personality, a man that really would have been worth taking the time to know in person if, and only if, we had had that chance. We're
right.
Discussing the music and the life of Gigi Grice with Noel Cohen, who has co-written a book about him, Rat Race Blues, The Musical Life of Gigi Grice, also authored by Michael Fitzgerald and published by Current Research in Jazz out in Maryland. Really recommendable book. And this is a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. And we're getting closer now to winding it down a little bit. I'm sure you have other things to do, but it really is a very interesting conversation for me. Getting the chance to actually, after a couple of years of being in touch with you over Facebook and email, getting a chance to chat with you is really a treat for me. The first album, Noel, that I ever heard by Gigi Grice was the one he did with Art Farmer, when Farmer met Grice, or what right. Is that the name of it?
That's the 12-inch.
Yes, I have it somewhere around here. When Farmer met Grice, and that's from...
That's basically a reissue of two 10-inch LPs. One was done in 1954 and one in 1955. Okay? And they put them together and then they called it When Farmer Met Grice. But the 10-inch, I think, were just called the Art Farmer Quintet, the 10-inch LPs.
Well, that is the first one I ever heard. And I was just stunned by not just the quality of the playing, but the freshness of the compositions, the interplay between everyone involved. It's a fantastic right. album that I absolutely recommend. But you have devoted a lot of time to listen to the music of Gigi Grice, to researching his life. What kind of recordings would you recommend our listeners out there to get? It doesn't have to be just one, just a bunch of recordings that you definitely recommend that people out there should listen to understand who Gigi Grice is as a musician.
Well, one of the problems is that I'm not even sure what's available these days. I would definitely recommend I think they recorded 5 albums just in the year 1957 of the Jazz Lab for different labels. I think that was probably the best group that Gigi ever had, was the one with Donald Byrd, if for no other reason that they recorded a lot, because the later groups with Richard Williams, and especially when he added Eddie Costa on vibraphone, that sextet, there's only the one album on Mercury, which can never really be reissued, because I understand that was lost in a fire or something like that. But that album called Reminiscent is very good, but it's just a taste. You know, we hear a little bit more on the Uptown Live, you know, thing recorded at Birdland of that band, but there's very little of that. Well, I would definitely recommend the Uptown, which is still available. But any of those Jazz Lab, there's, you know, one would be available from Fantasy. The one on Riverside, I guess, would be available from Fantasy. The 2 Columbias, I'm not even sure if those are still available. They came out on collectibles together with one track missing on collectibles. I don't know if that is still available, but I would definitely look for the Jazz Lab. And the albums that you mentioned with Art Farmer are fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, the early 1950s. And then the one called Nika's Tempo.
Yes.
Which was originally on Signal, then reissued on Savoy. I think that is still available, and that is excellent stuff too. That's the band, the nine-piece band with the tuba. Yeah, that's great stuff. And also, that also includes the quartet with Monk.
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe the Art Farmer sessions have been reissued on CD, and I believe I have it at home. I don't have it here in my office, but I believe by some European label, and it includes, I think it's either one or two CDs, but it includes all the recordings that Gigi Grice and Art Farmer made together. And that, of course, the ones on When Farmer Met Grice are, of course, there.
Yeah.
And those are particularly special to me, because they were the very first ones that I heard. But I agree with you in that the Jazz Lab is a fantastic, though short, period of his career. Could you tell us a little bit about that, the Jazz Lab? What kind of group was that?
Okay, the Jazz Lab to me is one of the typical hard bop bands of that era. Again, like I said, the Clifford Brown, ranking up there with the Clifford Brown, Max Roach Quintet, Horace Silver Quintet, the Jazz Messengers. You know, there were a few others that worked, you know, steadily. J.J. Johnson had a nice quintet during those years. J&K, remember? J.J. Johnson and Kay Winding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were bands that stayed together later. In more in the 60s were the Jazz Crusaders, you know. But I put the Jazz Lab up with those groups, and these groups were characterized by the things we talked about before. Great tunes, but use of interludes, use of shout choruses, use of codas, sometimes exotic introductions, you know, So yeah, I think the Jazz Lab, you know, was definitely one of the top bands of the 1950s.
Now, if we look at your website, addictoys.com, the Noel Cohen Jazz History website, we can see very clearly how knowledgeable you are about the jazz of the 1950s, which, by the way, is also the kind of jazz that I like the most. If I have not that I have to choose or anything, but I always find myself writing about or listening to music from that era. What do you think that jazz music from the 1950s had that perhaps is lacking in the jazz of today?
Oh,
I don't want to get you into trouble, really. And I'm not trying to say that the music of today has no value at all. But you know, if you have read my blogs, you know that I have big respect for the musicians from today that I like, because I only go. I can only go by what I like, and you know. So I'm not trying to get you to bash today's jazz scene. But is there something in that music that you wish was also? Let's put it a different way, just to make it more positive, more politically correct. That's right. Okay. Is there something about the music of the 1950s that you would like to see more of in today's jazz? Does that sound a little bit more PC or not?
Yeah. Okay. Certainly, we talked about melody. You know, melody is so important, not just for the musicians, but also for the audience. Something that they can whistle when they're walking out of the club, you know. Melody is so important. The other thing is to play, you know, to be able to play the melody as well as turning the melody inside out and upside down. You know, to learn the lyrics, remember who was it? Famous musician said, was it Prez that said, you need to learn the lyrics of a song to really play it?
It's either one or the other.
Those kind of approaches. The rhythm section. I like to hear rhythm sections that are unified, you know, not going off in three different directions. You know, I would like to hear, as I said before, the repertoire of the 1950s and even a lot of the 1960s be played more. And I would like that the way that people would listen to the compositions of that era and have that inform their own compositions. You know, I think that would be very useful. Again, jazz is a continuum. Mm-hmm. So I think that we need, you know, it's always useful to try to draw on all, you know, the different eras rather than just saying, listening to everything that came after John Coltrane or something like that. And let me say, you know, there are a lot of musicians that are playing in the tradition, you know, and Chris Byers and his bands are definitely part of that tradition. They're the people that play at Smalls and Smoke in New York. There are a lot of them, and it's good to see, you know, but... you know, that's all I'm going to say is I just think listen to the 1950s as well as the 1960s and beyond, and see if you don't get something out of that.
Yes, and definitely, yeah. Chris Byers and I talked about that the other day, as part of the conversation we had for the podcast I did with him. I think one of the things that Gigi Grice did was he did not really reject the standards, for example, but he would make different, newer, fresher arrangements of standards from the Great American Songbook, for example, to spruce them up a little bit to make them sound different. So, you know, that's something...
That great arrangement of Over the Rainbow on the first Columbia... Jazz Lab is a beautiful example of that.
And I think, you know, the songbook used as a source for new arrangements, new approaches to old things, which is basically what you're trying to say with the music of the 1950s, maybe reviewed, envisioned in a different way nowadays. So I think that's absolutely very, very valuable. Noel Cohen was our... guest on this lengthy edition of the Jazz Flashes podcast, but you know, it doesn't matter to me that it's a lengthy edition. In fact, the thing is, when I start talking about jazz with somebody who's knowledgeable like you are, It's very difficult to stop. You never know where to stop. You just have to stop because we only have so much time. But I could keep on talking for hours and hours and hours, and then I'd probably bore whoever might be out there listening to the podcast. But in any case, in this, it has been, Noel, an absolute pleasure for me to have had the chance to chat with you. It's not in person, but it's almost like it were in person because I can see you right here on my screen. And I would like to encourage everyone out there listening to the Jazz Flashes podcast to do two things. The first one is to go to addicttoys.com and check out Noel Cohen's Jazz History website. There's a lot of information. There's a lot of sources to acquire knowledge about some great musicians, mostly from the 1950s, but not only. On there, Noel Cohen's Jazz History website, addicttoys.com. That's addicttoys.com. That's one thing. The other thing is to get yourself a copy of Red Race Blues, The Musical Life of G.G. Grice, written by Noel Cohen and Michael Fitzgerald. It's already in its second edition, and it's an absolutely fantastic book. I was telling Chris the other day that Red Race Blues is one of my favorite books about jazz that I've read lately. And I read, you know, as much as I can find at the library in my university, or I buy a lot of books about jazz, and that's basically what I read for fun, what I read as a hobby. Now I read Spanish and British literature from the 16th and 17th century for work. That's what I do my research on mostly. But when it comes to reading about jazz, this is a book that it's absolutely recommendable. A fascinating story, like you said, and one that we can learn a lot from. Red Race Blues, The Musical Life of G.G. Grice. Once again, Noel, thank you so much. And I'll give you, just like, you know, whenever they have those political debates, I'll give you a final word now.
It just, all I can say is just thank you so much for having me and for your kind words and support. And appreciation of what I try to do, it's invaluable. I've thoroughly enjoyed these 2 hours, and hope to see you again sometime.
Well, so do I. And this has been a new edition of the Jazz Flashes podcast. It will be available on iTunes, on YouTube, and also in the Jazz Flashes blog that you can read at jazzflashes.blogspot.com. Thank you very much. We're signing off now. Thank you, Noel. See you anytime you want.